Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Is the mic working? Yeah, it's supposed to be on. Ah, good. Yes, so it's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank especially Pedro who for hosting me and my collaborators for the past 2 weeks, and actually for coming on time to this. Yeah, so the title of my talk was actually very difficult to choose. So what could be more appropriate in some way would be a very technocratic title like that, because the goal of this talk would be to present you a formula. We'll try to make it a bit more sexy by adding a subtitle, but that doesn't work. But so I'm going to present you a formula. But it's a formula that, if you stare at it in the right way, in the right setup, I believe makes a certain number of things clear. And for example, in theories in conformal field theories that have gravity dual, I think this formula, if you look enough long enough, this formula, I believe you will say, locality, it is clear. So I'll begin by setting some general context. So starting with sort of the more broader questions, going to the more specific ones. So there's a famous conjecture in the context of the gauge gravity duality, which is due to Boshinsky and collaborators a few years ago, which is that in any large N conformal field theory, if the theory has if the spectrum of operators in the theory has a special property, that there are very few operators with low dimension, then the conjecture is that any such theory has a gravity dual, and that this gravity theory is local down to a certain scale that is set by the spectrum. And to support this conjecture, what they prove is that if you look for all the possible solutions to crossing symmetry in the CFT, so this is using some consistency of the CFT, you find that all the solutions represent things which can be interpreted as local interaction in ADS with a diagram. So basically, Feynman diagrams of a theory in ADS. They prove that, but showing that you have Feynman diagram is not enough to see that the theory is local. You like to see that the coefficient of higher derivative interactions are small, so that you really have what's effectively a renormalizable theory, or nearly so in the bulk, effective theory in the bulk. So that left the big question, why are these interactions suppressed by powers of that mass, which is a locality? So we're going to revisit this question and believe largely answer it using new ingredients from the last year, which is that we've gained a lot of control over the high energy scattering, rigid limit in conformal field theories, so through some work that I will review shortly. And what this control will buy us is that we'll be able to have we'll be able to derive something which can be interpreted as a dispersion relation. Let me clarify a little bit. The physical picture is that the way we get the effective field theory in ADS is that we imagine starting with a full theory, which can have heavy modes, string modes, black holes, we integrate all that out. And if you look at long distances, you have an effective theory where all of these degrees of freedom generate contact interactions for you. And if these degrees of freedom are heavy, then in general, this kind of series expansion will converge nicely because this mass is large, and these coefficients get smaller and smaller. And as an example, in the famous ADS5 cross S5 duality, this mass is set by the string scale and the bulk. And mathematically, this kind of suppression would be clear if we had an equation that read something like a dispersion relation in the flat space limit. So a dispersion relation is something which expresses the amplitude in terms of its imaginary part. And if I tell you that the imaginary part comes from propagators like that are heavy, then this integral will start at some heavy scale, and then you can series expand it, and the coefficient will get smaller. So mathematically, this feature or locality will be obvious if you could derive something like a dispersion relation. The problem is that if you open the CFT textbooks, you look at the classic papers, people tell you all sort of things about crossing symmetry, OPs, and conformal field theories, but nobody writes an expression in CFT that will look like that. So if only we had such a formula, then okay, we'll understand locality better in EBS. That's one motivation for the work I will present. Another motivation is in the context of the CFT bootstrap, generally. So as many of you probably heard, so there's been a lot of progress recently on the solving control field theories from first principle. The input one uses is simply that the crossing symmetry, which in this context means that if you do an expansion, so you can look at some four-point correlator and you can expand it. You can do some series expansion in various limits, and all the series expansion should agree with each other. This doesn't look very constraining, but if you put in the input that all of these coefficients are positive, because the coefficients are squares of numbers, if you put in this positivity, it actually becomes very constraining. By roughly speaking, you can see that, just for completeness, if I can sketch a bit, if you imagine that you're slightly closer to one limit than the other, then all of these terms, then the terms will be smaller on one side than the other. But because it's the same coefficients on both sides, it looks like this equality is impossible to satisfy. But what happens is that the terms get bigger. For the first few terms, the size of the term gets reversed, and you have the other side dominate. So you get something which tells you, you get an equality between the first few, the low-lying spectrum, the first few guys are equal to positive sum of the other guys. And so you get to learn a lot about the low-lying spectrum. And people can generate more and more using computers, can generate more and more of these constraints, and you can solve, can eventually converge with some assumptions to actual theories. From the perspective of someone who like analytic works like me, this equation is really hard to work with. Because you get to generate all this constraint by evaluating this as various numbers and just imposing that this is positive. So one step forward is to try to invert on one side and have an expression. If you have an expression like that, that isolates the coefficient on one side, then you could try to analyze some limits or something. This equation is not obviously a step forward because you still have unknown coefficients on both sides of the equations. But there could be some limits where, you know, if you want to know about something about, say, the spin is large on one side or something, it could be that you can do some nice approximations on the other side and learn something. And indeed, this is what will happen. So when one writes this kind of an inversion formula, as I will explain, it's actually not unique because the coefficients are not completely independent of each other. Some relation between them. But our goal will be to find an inversion formula which not only inverts the OPE, but somehow will read like a bulk in the context of ADS-CFT, will have an interpretation as a bulk dispersion relation. Exactly what we'll be looking for. Yeah. So here's the outline. So I will start by deriving a baby dispersion relation, which will not be quite as good as we want, but will contain some physics, interesting physics. So I will spend most of the talk explaining what the ingredients are, and then go to some mathematics, tell you about the actual formula, and I will discuss its application to large spin operators and to theories with the gravity duals. So here's a setup. So we'll be considering correlation functions of four operators. It will be very important that we work in Minkowski space. So we put the operators in time run up, put them at some time and space direction. In principle, if all the operators remain space-like from each other, you're really not doing anything new. But we'll take these operators to cross the light cone. However, we'll only need two time-like distances. Next line. Yeah, okay. A bit too fast. So if I draw the operators like that, I'm going to work with the coordinates. So these are light cone coordinates, this picture. And if I take both these cross ratio to zero, this operator 3 and 4 go to the origin, and that's where you have the normal OPE expansion. So normally the OPE is a series expansion around the limit where the 3 and 4 collide. So what I would like to explain first, I would like to face directly the question. Suppose we had something like a dispersion relation in conformal field theory. What would be the analog of the imaginary part of the amplitude? So let's try to see if we can guess what the formula will look like. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the operators to be time-like separated in pairs like that. We're not going to need to cross these XO-like cones, so there's only two time-like separations. So everything takes place within two Rindler wedges. And the claim is that this certainly looks like a scattering amplitude, right? You're throwing this guy across whatever state this other guy is producing. So throwing two guys across each other. And the claim is that mathematically, this actually a scattering amplitude in the following sense, that the amplitude is smaller than one when you normalize it with some appropriate way, which tells you really that putting some obstacle in the way of something cannot make its amplitude to go through larger, can only reduce it. So here's a quick proof. The detail is not so important. I will quickly go through. But the point is that if you try to analyze this process using the S-channel OPE that I described before, go back, this OPE doesn't converge when you cross the like cone. That's its convergence radius. But you can look, you can use some other OPE. You have chalk? Yes. This picture will be useful for the talk. So if you do the OPE around the limit where these two guys collide, then the only thing that happens in this limit when you go from space-like to time-like is that the terms pick up a phase. So you start from an expansion, you multiply it by phases, and the only thing that can happen is make it smaller. And this OPE, when you use the clever variables, has the property that if a rho is larger than one, in absolute value, this is the same as when rho goes to one over rho. So what this means is that when you cross a like cone, greater than one, there's always a point in the Euclidean region to which you can compare such that the amplitude is the ratio is smaller than one. So the amplitude here is always smaller than that at some point here. So in that sense, this ratio is like a scattering amplitude. So as usual, when you have a scattering amplitude, it's nice to split it into a trivial part plus an actually interesting part, like that. And the fact that it's smaller than one means that the imaginary part of that guy is positive. So that will be the key thing we'll use. So people in the past in CFTs have introduced a Millin amplitude, which can also be interpreted as a kind of scattering amplitude. This is different. We're just looking at the correlation function, but going to time-like regime. Then we can take an imaginary part and be positive. Something which is unusual, but which will be important, is that normally the imaginary part of the amplitude is its discontinuity across a cut. In this case, because we start from the correlator, which has the one part, roughly, of the S matrix, to get the imaginary part of the amplitude, we have to take a double discontinuity. Like you take the imaginary part of M is the Euclidean correlator minus the amplitude above minus the amplitude below. It's not a discontinuity, it's a double discontinuity. And that's the thing which is positive. The fact that it's a double discontinuity will play a very important role shortly. But that's the correct analog to the imaginary part of the amplitude. It's not the discontinuity of the correlator. So in the complex plane, rho bar. We're looking at some configuration where rho is below 1, rho bar is above 1. What we need to do is take the amplitude here, plus the amplitude here, minus twice the amplitude. So this double discontinuity, let me put it in context, it has appeared in other papers recently. So for example, in the context of the abundant chaos, Massena, Schenker, and Stanford consider this kind of double commutator. This you see as four terms when you expand out the commutators. These four terms are exactly the four terms that I just described. So going to different sides of the cut is equivalent to changing the operator ordering. So what I'm looking at equivalently, I could say, is you have to look at this double discontinuity is also this double commutator. So it's a nice object because it's positive. And yeah, what they managed to show in that paper, yeah, so that's all I want to say for the moment. The fact that this imaginary part is positive also some quite far-reaching implication. It looks like something trivial, but if you take some, it turns out that you can take something that's like a corner limit. And what one can show is that this identity, that this S, that this amplitude is smaller than 1, holds not only for real kinematics, but it actually holds throughout the lower half plane. And if you use this property and use that in some Lycoln limit, it goes like a phase, then this phase becomes complex. And if you impose that the scattering amplitude is smaller than 1 in the upper half, it should be lower half, then you've learned that the coefficient of learning that this expectation value needs to be positive. So that's essentially the key ingredient of a recent proof of the average null energy condition from the statement that the amplitude is smaller than 1. And something I would like to mention is that it's quite impressive that there was 2 independent proofs last year of the average null energy condition. The other one used anti-angular moment entropy inequalities. It's very mysterious to me that there are, I think it would be very nice in the future to understand what the interplay is between these two different lines of reasoning, but yeah, it's very nice that there are different ways to think about this thing. So now that we have this ingredient, we have this amplitude, we understand what the imaginary part mean and so on, we can try to play the tricks that the games that people did in the 60s with the analytic S matrix. Next thing we'd like to do is write a dispersion relation. It's actually relatively easy, at least in the Ricci limit, which is a limit of large boost. So if I take this guy and boost it a lot, send it here, then the other one will be sent here, then here, here. Then, you know, I'm really scattering things around each other that are going very fast. And I will going to parameterize this limit with a large energy E until I'm working in coordinate space. So if we look at this amplitude, I said it's analytic in some half plane. And if you go at high energies, this branch cut looks like it shrinks to the origin. And you can immediately write a contour integral representation for the amplitude in terms of what it is on the real axis and what it is at infinity. This inequality that I shown before implies that it is bounded here, and it's actually bounded also in the circle at infinity. So you can actually drop the circle at infinity, and all it gives you is a constant. So what's the input here? So to show that the things is bounded on that cut, use the T-channel expansion, which is expansion around that branch point. To show that it's bounded here, you need to use the U-channel. So if you use positivity of the OPE in both channels, you can show that this integral works. You can drop the contour at infinity, and you get the following representation, where C is the value at infinity. So very similar formulas appeared before. So I'd like to discuss a bit the physics of formulas of this type. These formulas actually contain a lot of physics, because physics come from the fact that in this case, the imaginary part of M is positive. This is double discontinuity that I talk about. So the fact that it's positive on the real axis, if you just take the dispersion relation and take the imaginary part, be a y on top, but yeah. If you just take the imaginary part, then that's how you can see immediately that the imaginary part is positive throughout the upper half plane, and that's how you derive the NX, for example. Other thing you can do is you can take a derivative of this expression, and if you take the derivative and you subtract the correct thing, you find that you actually get something with a specific sign. And what you learn from that inequality is that the local rate of growth of the amplitude cannot be faster than linear. And when you convert to Rindler time, this is essentially the bound of chaos, which was so the bound of chaos is a statement that's true in any theory. If you apply it to a conformal field theory in Rindler space, it becomes the argument that I just presented. and so it's just a statement about this dispersion relation encodes both of these things automatically. So it's a nice thing to look at. And the next thing I want to say is that this imaginary part of the amplitude is an awesome object. You should like it. Another thing which is nice about it is if you look at large n and you plug in the cross channel expansion. So in general, at large n, the OP has a, you can split into single traces and double trace and so on. And the main feature of large n is that the double trace operators have a very small anomalous dimension, proportional to 1 over n. If you plug in this, if you start to expand in this exponent, the cool thing is that if you want to take a discontinuity, right, this imaginary part, remember, is a double discontinuity. So if you want to get something non-zero, you need at least log square. A single log will not do it. If you need log square. And this log square is proportional to 2 powers of the anomalous dimension. And if you do the large n counting, this is the equivalent of having a loop, a 1 over n loop. So the leading order and the 1 over n expansion, this imaginary part cares only about single traces. So it's also a very nice object from the viewpoint of large n. So this dispersion relation is basically a formula which tells you how to reconstruct the correlator from single trace operators. So you put the correlator, you put a correlator in general from the single trace in the cross channel. There's a small caveat that will come back. But that formula really, if it really completely worked, that will tell you that it will give you that. And that is a nice interpretation in theories with the ADS dual. It's telling you that the imaginary part of this amplitude comes from diagrams come from processes where exchange something single trace, which are indeed the propagating modes in the bulk theory. So in ADS CFT, this is completely natural, and this really justifies calling this correlator an amplitude. One can play a few games, so as before, you can try to ask what happens when you cut a particle which is very heavy. Its contribution will be proportional to a large power delta gap, which is pushing it to some other sign. So it decays exponentially in terms of its variable as you go from the Ricci limit. What you learn is that it decays, it's completely invisible at low energies, and a heavy operator only becomes visible at energies of order of the gap, where energy here measures how much you boosted. So if you use that and you plug it into this dispersion relation that I just wrote, you see that the coefficients in the low energy expansion will decay like powers of it. So this dispersion relation really does behave like a dispersion relation in EDS, like you would want. So the conclusion so far. So all we've done is we've looked at this four-point function. We've written it in this funny way as 1 plus I m, where m is a non-trivial part, and that non-trivial part obeys a dispersion relation, which can be interpreted in the flat space limit of ADS as a dispersion relation. The formula so far has nothing to do with ADS CFT, but if you use it in theories that have ADS CFT interpretation, it tells you that. There's a caveat. Caveat, let me go back a few slides. Turns out that the physics is very nice on that cut, where the double discontinuity around that cut as an interpretation of only project out single traces. There's this little cut here, which shrinks to 0 when you're in the Ricci limit. But if you try to use the formula away from the Ricci limit, it gets more and more important. And its double discontinuity is not given by only single traces. It's completely different physics there. There are dragons there, I'm told. So the formula is not as good as you would like, but at least in the Ricci limit, it works so far. So in the rest of the talk will be about overcoming this caveat and try to get a formula that looks like a dispersion relation, but which is valid for all coordinate, not just in this limit. Actually, we'll not be able to do that, but we'll be able to get the equivalent for a formula that extracts OPE coefficients. And the way we'll do it is using some group theory. So I should post to ask there are feel free to ask any question at any point. So yeah, if we only if we could extend this nice construction beyond the rigid event. So now we have to start. We have to change our target. So we're trying to reconstruct the correlator from the double discontinuity. And that is hard. And the reason it's hard here is that the correlator is a function of two variables. And it's not clear which one you're supposed to fix away from this limit. So we're going to turn our focus away from the correlator to the OPE coefficients. So in the context of a flat space S matrix, so again, if you open the analytic S matrix, this would be explained. There's a way to invert the analog of OPE data here, which are partial wave coefficients. There's a way to extract this coefficient, this data, in terms of the discontinuity of the amplitude. So is the way, and the basic is a question. So when you open these books, they always tell you that partial waves are analytic in spin. And then you ask why. And the Forsberg Gruber formula is the explanation why it is. The formula is basically just contour integral. So I'm going to introduce this variable because I will use it later. Let's consider a variable which is exp of I theta. So it's basically the angular integral that you do to project on the partial wave is integral over this circle. So to project on a partial wave, basically you integrate over the circle times exp of ij theta. That will project them to some partial wave. And the trick is just to deform the contour. You start from here, and then you deform the contour. And what you get is an integral over the discontinuity of the amplitude. And this branch cut here comes from the amplitude, not from W, there's nothing there. And the amplitude here, there's a T-channel cut. And this funny variable, because this is I theta, there's a symmetry that W goes to 1 over W, so there's two reflections of the cut in this picture. I'm grabbing this one here because this W goes to 0 here. So just by contour deformation, you can deform the contour to get the discontinuity. And if you express it in terms of what the usual variable is, in terms of the usual variable, this gives you a formula for the coefficient as some integral over the cut and the imaginary part of the amplitude times something which decays like the spin, and this eta is some function of t that decays. One thing which would be important also is that, let me go back. There's two cuts, so there's a T-channel cut on the right, there's a U-channel cut on the left. Both of them contribute, but the U-channel one comes with next minus 1 to the J. So in general, what you learn is that even spins and odd spins form two separate analytic functions of spin. And that is true in any, that was true in the S, in any S matrix theory. The other thing which is you need to know is that this integral does not, this contour deformation does not always converge nicely. So when you shrink this contour, there can be some little arc close to the origin. This arc, which looks smaller than this picture, is really the rigid limit that I mentioned. Yeah. And depending on how the theory behaves in the rigid limit, you may or may not be able to drop this arc. So what happens in general is that the formula may not work for first few spins, but then if you put the spin high enough, it will work, because then this power of W to the J kills the origin. So in general, all spin, partial wave coefficient analytic in spin for spin large enough. We see that in CFT, it will work for spins above 1. And let me just explain a little bit the group theory, because it feels confusing at first to talk about continuous spin. But the point is very simple, is that the reason we normally think about spin being integer is that we think about rotation. If you do a rotation by 360 degrees, you come back to yourself, so spin has to be quantized. But you know, we live in a world that's controlled by Lorentz symmetry, and we also have boosts. And the eigenvalues of boost really don't have to be integers. It really doesn't make sense to have integer eigenvalue for boost. So if you think about a situation like the energy limit where you really care about the eigenvalues of boosts, then you really care about the continuous spectrum. The representations are continuous are important. And the nice thing is that, you know, boost and rotation, they fit together inside the same group. They are related to each other. And this formula, this Fossard-Gilbert formula, tells us how boost and rotation are related to each other. That's really the point of it. So if you analytically continue to have a spin to be an integer, then you would reduce to the rotation. So that was a derivation of the Fossard-Gilbert formula in flat space. How do we extend this derivation in a CFT? So in CFT, the operators are labeled by spin and dimension, and both of these things are discrete. The first step actually will be to make the dimension continuous. That is still something you can do in the Euclidean case. And after that, we'll do the spin. We'll make the spin continuous also, a formula like that. And really, it would not make sense to make the spin continuous only and have the spectrum discrete, because I mean, these delta and j are really coupled to each other. Different operators have different dimensions. If you try to continue its spin, you really have to continue in dimensions also. Fortunately, the first step, making dimensions continuous, was already done a few years ago by other people. And they obtained an expression for the correlation function. Instead of a sum over blocks, it's an integral. It's a continuous integral over blocks. And this integral has a flavor of an inverse Laplace transform, where you just integrate over imaginary dimensions. The curious thing is that what you have to put in the integral is block plus shadow. It's a magic combination that is single-valued. And that combination is a property that the Casimir of the conformal group are self-adjoint when they act on single-valued functions. As I said, the contour is like a Abelian transform, because these blocks basically look like power laws, function of dimension. And this formula reproduces the usual one, provided that these coefficients have poles at the right place. So if you just do, just like a Abelian transform, if you have poles at the right place, you get power series. So this is just a way of encoding the OP data into an analytic function of delta, which will have poles where the operators are. So where the pole is tell you what the dimension of the operator is, and the residue tell you the coefficient. So that was done already. An inverse to this formula has been discussed in recent work. So I will not spend too much time. This is what I'm saying here. You can invert this formula. You can think of this F as a complete basis of eigenfunctions. So the way you extract a coefficient is you just integrate against it. So there's a formula that tells you that if you integrate the correlator against this block, you invert, you get its coefficient back. So the integral is still Euclidean here. You're just integrating on the whole Euclidean plane. Well, that's an interesting formula. We could spend a lot of time on it. I will not, because it's not the formula we want. We want a Lorentzian formula. So here's how we're going to do the next and final step. So we introduce, again, the same variable that we use in the flat space case, this x of I theta, this angular variable. And then the angular part of the integral is interpreted as a circle. You have to do it in the right variable, it doesn't matter so much. But in the right variable, then the picture will be exactly as in flat space. You have the T-channel cut on one side, the U-channel cut on the other side. So the T-channel cut is when you cross here, and the U-channel cut is when you take this operator and you cross it the other side. So it looks exactly as in flat space. We can play the same game. But what are we supposed to use as functions? The blocks are a bit more complicated than cosine of theta. And in fact, if you study the Casimir equations which define the block, what you learn is that there's 8 basic solutions. The 8 solutions are related by this symmetry. So there's one symmetry which reverses dimension, one symmetry which reverses spin, one symmetry which will inverse exchange dimension and spin. What that means is that you start from a solution, we start from a conformal block, you did this substitution, you get another thing which solves the same equation, but with different boundary condition. And remember, we'll be looking to find functions which vanish close to this little corner, the rigid image in the middle. So we'd like to decompose our block plus shadow into two parts, one of which is nice in one limit, and the other part is nice in the other limit. Exactly like we split the cosine into two pits, which are nice in opposite limits. So simple group theory problem. It's slightly harder because this function has branch cuts, and we start with a function which is defined in the Euclidean region, which is roughly here, and we're trying to split it into a part which is nice here, plus a part which is nice here. So we have to do some analytic continuation across branch cuts. And there's some formulas you can derive for the monodromy of these blocks. I'll not describe them, but that you can do. So you can do this monodromy and impose these constraints. And what you find, let me go back, is that so there's only two out of the eight solutions, there's two which are nice. So you're trying to express this function here as a sum of the two things which are nice here plus the two things which are nice the other side. So that gives you, and it's an eight-dimensional vector space. So that gives you four parameters and eight constraints. So for a long time, I had a mantle block. It's silly to expect a solution. But if I succeeded at this point in the talk, you really want this formula. And you really want it badly, so you're willing to try. And there is a solution. I don't understand so well why this is a solution, but I will describe you the solution.
Excuse me, is there any argument that there should be a solution?
No.
Or is it just a coincidence?
There's no argument so far.
Okay.
This analogy motivates that there should be a solution. That's it. Yeah. So as before, we get a sum of two parts such that even and odd spins are separately analytic. And if you just look at one of them, you get an integral or some block or some discontinuity. So let's focus on the schematic formula. The schematic formula is this. So it's a formula which extracts the S-channel OP coefficient as integral over the blocks. The integration region is some nice causal diamond. And you can plug in the cross-channel OP expansion, and it's a region where the cross-channel expansion converges. So in principle, you could do the integral term by term. The inverse block in the middle is a usual conformal block, but with spin and dimension exchange. It's funny. And the formula is guaranteed to converge for j greater than 1. And that has to do with when you go to the rigid limit, which sits in the corner here, that has to do with the function being bounded here. So the boundedness in this limit ensures this convergence. So for spin zero, the formula tells you nothing in principle about spin zero. But all the other spins, but spin one neither. But spin two and above, the formula tells you something. Let me skip over that. So we can do some boring tests, like you can look at some correlators that are known, for example, 2D CFT like the Ising model. You can just plug them into the formula. So we can take the double discontinuity. You can check that it's positive. You can do the integral. It turns out you can actually do the integral analytically. So you have some, like the blocks are some 2F1 in two dimension. You integrate them against this parallels. You get some 3F2 funky arguments. And then you check. So the point in life of this formula, of this this function cj of delta, that is supposed to have poles where you have operators. So you have to, so we can take the residues of 3f2 times 3f2 that you get, compute the residue, it spits you out these numbers, and then you check if the OP with these coefficients reproduce the correlator, and it works perfectly. The formula just works. small comment. Don't try Mathematica as residue on this. Mathematica doesn't work well with 3F2s. So we have, anyway, at the end, I have to take the residues, approach the limit numerically, and rationalize the result. Otherwise, it get garbage. Actually, my advice would be to never work with 3F2s if you can. But anyway, that example works. Now I'd like to discuss some more interesting applications. So one of the goals of this kind of inversion formula was to see if in some limit you could it would give you some nice approximation to the spectrum. So there's a standard story that the large spins in one channel are dual to the lowest twist in the cross channel. And the way this theory comes about roughly is that you look at some double Lycoun limit where you it's useful to think about some other coordinate system. We put some operator at 0, 1, infinity, and the other at z bar. And if you go to this, there's a corner, you should get 45 degrees. If you go to this corner, you're null separated from two guys at the same time, and you can try to analyze this using either OPE. What you learn from this limit is that basically if you want to reproduce a singularity in one channel, you have to have infinitely many terms in the other channel. And the power of the singularity tells you the how this data has to depend on spin. So if you sum up the OP coefficient decay like 1 to the j to alpha, you generate a singularity with that power in the cross channel. And that, if you know where the lowest twist operators are in one channel, you can use this kind of equation to solve an asymptotic series as a net. You can solve for the spectrum as an asymptotic series at large spin. So that's a long-standing story. It's been very successful. So we can try to produce this story from our formula. What happens from this inversion formula? Let me just write a simplified version of it. So the important part of the block is that there's some power of z in front. And recall that the OPE data is encoded in the poles. And these poles just come from the endpoint of integration. So even though we have a two-dimensional integral, one of them is really trivial. It's just done by its boundary. And really, the non-trivial integral is over z bar. The way it works is that if the amplitude goes like a power of z in that limit, the z integral just gives you this pole, which is nice. You interpret as the exchange of an operator of twist tau. And then the OPE coefficient and everything is encoded in that integral of z bar. And what you see from that integral now, if you take the spin to be large, you see that's going to kill the integration for z small. So it's going to push you to the boundary where z bar goes to 1. So if you just, I just give you this formula and ask you to expand this formula at large spin, you will discover that you have to go to this corner.
Can we just see that the large spin expansion is asymptotic series in
principle? In a second. So, okay, so now we have to do this integral over the corner limit of the amplitude. That limit, these integrals are not so easy, but one thing you can do is expand the amplitude in some power of this variable. Why I chose this variable? It turns out because that's some integral that I'm able to do analytically. If I try to just put 1 minus z bar, it's expanding around z bar equal 1. If I don't put the 1 over z bar, I cannot do this integral. But if I put this funky power and I can do and get a nice result in terms of gamma functions, and this behaves, this decay at large spin, like 1 over spin to the tau. So right, this is the duality between this power and the decay at large spin, as you would expect. So this is some integral you can do analytically. And what I claim is that the result on this 1 over j expansion literature, you can reproduce if you just expand the cross-channel OPE in power of that variable and use that formula. So. And you can see why it's asymptotic, because this does not converge for z bar smaller than half. So you miss half the integration region. That's the answer. So that formula nicely reproduced many results. This particular kernel was somehow guess from the inverse of this argument by Simmons-Duffin recently. So you, if you open this paper, you recognize the exact same formula, derived the other way. And the thing which is conceptually new here is that, okay, in principle, we can expand term by term and use this formula, but there's no need actually to expand in this variable. It's, we just did it because we happen to know this integral. But in principle, we could just try to do the integral numerically. So here's some results, or not for me. So these results are results that people obtain using this asymptotic series. Just tell you, the asymptotic series really allow you to understand this very, very spectacular plot. So you do a 1 over j expansion, you extrapolate it to small j, and you cross your fingers, and actually it goes all the way to the stress tensor, which is j equal 2, and you land to like between 10 to the minus 3 of its twist. So in 3D Isaac, this asymptotic expansion really worked well. I haven't tried yet to redo this plot with the convergent expansion, but I've tried so far and it doesn't change so much the plot. It's already so good. So what is new here is the following. So instead of having an asymptotic expansion, now we can have a convergent sum. The other conceptual thing is we have control over individual spins, not just the average sum overall. So there can be nothing sticking out. So let me go back to this plot. Right, the way these arguments work, let me come back even 2 slides. The way the previous argument worked is that you want to reproduce a singularity in one channel, and that predicts the tail of the sum in the other channel. So that predicts the tail, but how do you know that this guy doesn't stick out? It's not going to change the equation. You're not going to see it from this asymptotic expansion, that one guy stick out. But in this convergence expansion, you can see that, OK, it cannot stick out because the thing you're summing is a bunch of small numbers. So it gives you control of the individual guys. And OK, if it's a convergent sum, then now we can hope to try to bound the errors and really use this as an input to the numerical bootstrap. The other application I would like to discuss is in the context of ADS CFT. So what happens when you plug in a FA operator in a cross channel? So as I was mentioned before, but just by virtue of being FA, that operator will it has a large power of 1 minus z, which if this power is large, give you essentially an exponential decay as you go away from 0. So a cross channel block with a large dimension gives you a contribution to the integral that looks like that. And the reason this is important here, maybe I should remind you of that. Even in a theory with a large n theory, you always have the double traces. What's very important here is that we have this double discontinuity which kills out double traces for us. So when you care about the single traces, and in the theory with the theories are conjectured to have a gravity dual, there's very few of these. There's a graviton, there's a few of them, stress tensor, and then there's heavy guy. So here I'm looking at one of the heavy guys. But it's very important that we have the double discontinuity to kill all the junk before we could look at that. So just by virtue of this exponential decay, which push the integral to z goes to 0, that integral will give you something that's suppressed by that decay like this, with the spin. So the behavior of this block with the spin and dimension exchange decay at large spin like that. This is just saying that you're integrating a function of z bar, which decays exponentially. The size of this region is of order one over delta. So if you're integrating a power law against in this region, you get something that's small, especially if that power is big. So this is just the shrinking of the FA contribution. So right, you can see this decay with spin. Can get slightly better bound because for spin 2, we know we have to get the stress tensor and we know the quotient gives. And then by virtue of the function being positive definite, and the function is bounded by 1 everywhere. So if you get a certain integral for the stress tensor, then you know that j equal 2, you know that if you increase the spin, you're only going to get something smaller. So there's some, and by that amount. So you can get something that's more refined. This. So let's compare this to expectation. So what was known? So if you have a conformal field theory that has large n in a large gap, it was already known that all the solutions to crossing symmetry correspond to Witten diagrams. But for a given spectrum of like operators, the solutions are ambiguous by contact interactions. What this formula tells us is that NLC in spin singles out, so this formula singles out a unique solution up to small correction due to the Healy guys, which are smaller than that. There's unique, out of all these solutions, there's a unique one which is singled out by this formula, which puts in this principle of NLC in spin and the rigid limit. So let's just look at the picture. So that's basically tell you that the coefficient decay like you would expect. There's actually when you compare the things in detail, so what you expect in the SCFT is that the coefficient of operators with many derivatives are suppressed depending on the dimension of the operator. What we've proved is that they're suppressed by their spin, which in general is weaker. So the spin depends on how the derivative are arranged, are contracted with each other. So the spin in some channels. But this decay with spin is the same as a certain, what was called a causality bound that was conjectured recently, this paper, and which basically amounted from the, having a bulk dispersion relation with converge. And then what sets the convergence dispersion relation is the behavior in the rigid limit in the bulk theory. So using bulk physics, people are expected to be able to prove that using a dispersion relation. Indeed, our formula behaves exactly like a dispersion relation in the bulk. Let me just discuss a little bit more the difference. So there are some sporadic interactions with few derivatives that remain unconstrained. For example, consider an ADS interaction, which in a flat space limit will look like this polynomial of Mandelstam variables. If you take this polynomial, if you take it in the rigid limit, like there's a relation between u and s plus t, in the rigid limit, which is large s and t fixed, this grows like s squared. So this thing has spin 2. And that's spin 2 in all channels, actually. So this guy doesn't have a constrained coefficient, the formula. Its coefficient cannot be bigger than the stress tensor, which also has spin 2. But that's all we can see. However, from effective field theory, we expect this guy to have a smaller coefficient because it has many derivatives. That's an example of the thing we cannot prove yet. But if you start to add more derivatives, anything you write down with a polynomial that's high order will have spin 3 or higher in at least one channel. So anything else you can write down will have small coefficients. So that's the conclusion. So we obtained a novel formula which expresses the S-channel OP data as some integral over a block. You can use some convergent T-channel representation for the amplitude, for the correlator, sorry. This representation, this integral, is valid in any unitary CFT. It has nothing to do with EDS CFT. It relies on the good rigid behavior, which itself was derived from the usual axiom of OP coefficient is positive. And this formula, when you apply it to theories which happen to have expected gravity duals, it gives you bounds on the higher derivative interactions, which essentially encode that the theory is local. Thank you.
So I was wondering how your formula works for like a 3 field theory, like a 3 n equals 4. Because in that case, like the dimensions are all integers. So I would say like the double discontinuity is 0.
Yeah. But in fact, think about the propagator in the free theory. What's the discontinuity of 1 over x squared?
Mm-hmm.
It's a delta function of x squared. Not 0.
Okay.
So there's a delta function at 1, yeah. And there's always singularity somewhere. That's how it works.
I see. But if you kind of consider it from the T-channel OP point of view?
Yeah, so in the T-channel, when you do the T-channel expansion, so the correlator and the normal S-channel normalization, it would be some power of z over 1 minus z, 1 minus z bar, would be to some power mm-hmm. times the block in the other channel. Mm-hmm. And even if all of these powers here are integer, mm-hmm. this thing here is enough to give you that singularity.
Okay, that part.
Yeah. But you would only, what will happen is very nice, you will only care about finitely many guys in the cross channel. Mm-hmm. Because let's say this power is 10, because you're looking at some operators with many fields, mm-hmm. then okay, you will just care about the first 10 guys in this series, basically. So this is series in powers of 1 minus z. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At least we care about finitely many twists, mm-hmm. more precisely.
That term STU that you said you couldn't control, isn't that like the matrix? If those were gravitons, it would be like the matrix element of R cubed.
Yeah.
Which would violate supersymmetry. So somehow.
Yeah, with
supersymmetric case, you can eliminate that.
Yeah, I think with supersymmetric case, yeah, with supersymmetry, I think I can eliminate a bunch of these. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure if you can eliminate all of them, but there was a paper last year by Rastelli someone else at Stony Brook, who essentially put in the same physics. So they look at the Millin representation of amplitude, and they put in the input that the correlator should remain in the rigid limit, remain bounded in the rigid limit, should not go faster than graviton exchange in the rigid limit, which is exactly what we put in it.
Yeah,
and if you put in that physics, they show that it was unique using the supersymmetry. So yeah, for in the case of N-course 4 supersymmetry, it seems to fix everything. Sorry, that would be CFT with N course 4 supersymmetry.
So can you say a few words about how to use this formula to recoupling?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a more general setup which is identical to recoupling, which is loops, the one ring N expansion in general. So put it somewhere. Okay, let me just write it. So apart from these guys, which are which have this delta function discontinuity, in general the double discontinuity is proportional to sine square of pi delta. So it's double discontinuity, so you get it vanishes quadratically as the dimension become integer. It's integer here from double trace technically. So the way you use it, so if you want to do something that's like one loop in perturbation theory, like leading order, then you can ignore these guys. Because right, this is like pi times an enormous dimension, and that's like two-loop effect. So, but to do the two-loop calculation, you will need to know what so this formula tells you that all you care about a two loop is how the squares of the n-mers dimension of one loop. Always one loop lower. That's very similar. So Perlmutter, Aldai, Giboydoff, and Aroni had a paper on loops in EDS last fall, and this intuition was there from Brain Space. But it's slightly misleading to phrase it like that. Because this endless dimension is really a matrix, and this is a square of a matrix. So really, to do the full calculation, you have to resolve you have to be able to know the endless. You have to be able to know the full matrix.
Can you say? I think we'll go a bit slower. So at one loop first, mm-hmm. you say that you can relate the one loop three-point function with just data from the fit theory, because it's just from the delta function that Shoto was mentioning.
Yeah. So the one loop coefficient are some integral of delta function. And then the two-loop OP coefficients are some integral over gamma square.
Plus the delta function as well.
Plus the delta function, yeah. This gamma is something that, in principle, you've determined. If you look at all of the four-point functions, not just those of the lightest operators, but if you know the four-point function for all the operators at one loop, in principle, you can compute gamma square.
So, I don't know if it makes sense, but I would say like the cross ratios are kind of conjugate variables to the energy or dimension. But in your formula, like the cross ratios are playing the roles of energy.
It's really just because I was that part of the talk, I was thinking about the rigid limit specifically. So if you take two operators and you boost them a lot, really, like this guy and this guy become very close to each other. And what's going to happen is that there's going to be an excitation with very high energy, which will propagate across. And the energy of that excitation will be set by 1 over that distances. So in the limit of large boost, it really doesn't matter whether you're thinking about coordinates or momenta.
Okay, so it's important to go to Lorentzian.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's conjugate.
But it's only in this limit that they're equivalent. So a large boost means the same for, large boost imply large energy no matter which space you're working in.
Can you define in a little more detail the causal diamond that you said you were integrating over? Because I see 4 points, and I'm not sure which are causal.
So fix 3 at 0, 1, infinity.
Okay.
Then the fourth one is integrated over that region. So it's a Lycombe that's bounded by that all the points that are space-like from 2 of the other points. In the original picture, in the coordinates that I was drawing at the beginning of the talk, which are somehow a double cover of that, it doesn't look like a diamond. But yeah, in this coordinate, it looks like a diamond.
Which plane is that?
That's a ZZ bar plane. It's a plane where you fix 3 of the orbitals at 0, 1, infinity. Yeah, and the rest of the talk, I had a more symmetrical picture where I fix 2 orbitals at plus or minus 1 and plus or minus rho. And this rho plane, the physics is a bit different.
So this scene of J and delta, there J and delta are thought as being continuous, both.
Correct.
So I want to extract the standard scene. What do I do there? I take a pole.
Yeah, so for a given j, so you can imagine fixing j to be an integer, then in the delta plane there will be some poles, and this pole will be where you have operators at that spin that you fixed.
And the residue is a 3-point function.
Correct. Square.
And on the right-hand side, it only converges when this, when delta is smaller than that.
Yes.
But then the first pole I find is the first one, and if I want to get the other ones, I would have to do some kind of integration by parts.
Yeah, correct. So for a given spin, there will be a bunch of operators, and as also to the left also, right. The sum converges until you hit that point. If you try to get very close to that pole, then you will get the divergence. But you, even without going to the pole, you can get some weighted averages of the guy. You can get some information. But then to go past this, you have to do some subtraction.
And now, why can't you now multiply the left-hand side by the block and sum it and get what you want, the dispersion relation for G? What's the deal?
These blocks are complicated. You can try. I haven't tried so hard actually. But yeah, this is how you would divide it. But
is there any analog of the Steinman relations, that is to say of mutual consistency of cuts in different channels, if not in the 4-point and higher point correlators?
Yeah, not that I know, right? Because in coordinate space, so what's this discontinuity is the other side is more room. What did we do is we had some operators, then we make them time-like, and then we took a discontinuity. There's 2 different ways of doing that. And then there's the operator on the other side. So basically, we took a discontinuity in that environment and that environment together, which somehow created some jet of particles going between this and this. And you can go further. You can push this point past a light cone until it becomes null from that guy. And as far as we know, that you can take a 3rd discontinuity, which would be non-zero. And you can even take a 4th one if you push this point up. So all of these seem are non-zero. There doesn't seem to be. Maybe there's something else that you will interpret as Steinman, but at least not that.
If there's no more questions, let's take our break.